registered for the event, so I'm glad to see no one's sitting in each other's laps at this stage at least. You know, feel free. So just to add a bit to what Anna Maria has explained, so about 5 months ago, Beatrice Liverpool University got this Impacts grant. At the same time, we were talking about what we might do for this IMDE research cluster. And it seemed that we could do two things. We could, on the one hand, do two separate events, and on the other hand, bring them together. And so what we've tried to do is think about, for today, how we could envisage a project or a series of projects that might link to about how the social media environment can effectively better engage our audiences. Tomorrow, the same kind of principle for working within the healthcare sector and within the environmental sector. So we thought those were two wonderful prospects in themselves, but we also thought to bring them together would be interesting as well, and that's partly because there's a lot of discussions about the relationship between art and talent. So what we hope to do, partly through tonight's reception, is to allow you to join some of the people from tomorrow and to, I guess, collectively interrogate what that relationship should be. Because there's been quite a few years of trying to do arts and health work, but this has met some criticisms. The idea that arts would be instrumentally therapeutic to health is a notion that a lot of people are now interrogating, I think, quite strongly. So one of the things we want from today, in particular, I think, is to flesh out what actually isn't happening yet in the arts sector. So in what ways could the arts sector be better serviced by social media? What things are existing already? And I think this is where we will rely a lot on your contribution to tell us what you've tried, what isn't working, how you actually operationalise social media within your work environment, for instance, which of course is one of those things that's very difficult to do. Anyone that's been or worked with a kind of web officer within an organisation knows how hard it is to get colleagues to blog, to get them to do anything at all online. And so, you know, I'm glad to see already a few laptops open, a few tweets coming out of Twitter already. So hopefully we'll be a bit further along by the end of this. But what we want to do is try to tease out what work is still left to do in order that we might think about putting together projects, reasonably sized projects, that could help us investigate how to do this better. And I think that's really all I want to say about that. But hopefully it'll become clearer as we go through the afternoon what this precisely will involve. So I guess I can introduce Steve Fuller now. And it's my pleasure to have Steve with us again here in back. Steve came along to, what was it, the Human Futures slot. So the book we have over here on the left-hand side is the book, as Laura mentioned earlier, that was published by FACT more or less towards the end of last year. And Steve has a contribution in here which doesn't wholly describe his contribution to scholarly inquiry. Steve is quite difficult to pin down in that respect. I like to think of Steve as the kind of new wave of public intellectuals that we have in the UK, people that are making critical observations on a range of social governmental structures. His work conveys that very clearly. He's also very, very knowledgeable about the internet, working on the editorial board of Information, Communication and Society, one of the long-standing journals in this area. And when thinking about this session, when thinking about what we ought to talk about, it seemed that a nice way to kick it off would be to think about some of these big picture questions that surround us on the internet. Because some of the things we're dealing with, we understand more or less, we understand somewhat what's different about Web 2.0 compared to Web 1.0, although we know there are some common ground as well. But trying to interrogate what actually the internet should look like and how it might function in a few years from now. Some people are already arguing that we're at Web 3.0, we're probably Web 2.5. If that's a reason. But the principle is quite intriguing. I'm not sure how much Steve will talk to this, but we have, unfortunately, Mike Stubbs, CEO of FACT, couldn't be with us today. He sent me a personal tweet today to convey what we were talking about this yesterday over a barbecue. And he thought that, I guess, his aspiration for Web 3.0 is that this should lead to the kind of collective intelligence that we imagined would take place around about Web 1.0. So when we started to read these kinds of texts that would aspire to these, you know, consensual hallucination, as it was put, that we exist in this hive mind and that we share all our resources and that, you know, everybody is equal and so on. that this might actually be furthered more effectively by 2.0. And through 2.0, we see somewhat of a democratization of technology. People can blog, people can publish, people can do things that in 1.0 was much harder to do. And so we see this remarkable expansion of the kinds of contributors online that just weren't there before, which I think is really interesting. But of course, the concern about this is that we might end up in a situation where we just have, and you know this, you know, anyone that's argued with anyone else about why they're not on Facebook says, I just don't want to tell people what I have for breakfast. You know, that's basically people's objection, this mundane triviality that people dismiss as the core content of 2.0. So, Web 3.0, and I don't know how much Steve will talk. You talk much about this, Steve?
So the argument, so far you're okay.
So the point is, before I finish, very simply convey 3.0. 3.0 might be conveyed in the following way. To come to this event, you will have gone to the website, you will have emailed a couple of people, you will have done this, that, and the other. 3.0 involves you just asking a question, and then your computer tells you everything about where you need to go, and, you know, it's effectively your purpose. It's all about this kind of collective artificial intelligence that leads to your being able to. So with that, Steve will tell us that we're likely to find ourselves in a situation of collective artificial intelligence or network idiocy, which Mike is very concerned about. Steve.
Okay. All right. Okay, first of all, there will be a question period after this?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good, because you might have a lot of questions after this. First, I want to thank Andy and Beatrice for inviting me, and also their indulgence in not really knowing what I'm going to say here. In a sense, it reflects kind of the open-ended nature of the situation that we're in now. But I do want to talk about what this Web 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 business is about. And in particular, I think what I can bring to this, perhaps, is some sense of, what are the historical templates for this, right? Because there's a sense in which there's a kind of ongoing narrative that's being told, and of course this is going to be based on things that have happened in the past with other information technologies in history. And so, in a sense, that's kind of the perspective that I'm coming to this. Basically, it seems to me that I think Andy's got it right, with the whole business of Web 1.0 was the idea that you manage through information and communication technologies to get this incredible scaling up and the ability to transmit and to accumulate information. Okay, so there's a sense in which, in terms of the sheer physical parameters, that's kind of what Web 1.0 was about, right? And that's a very impressive thing in its own right. And Web 2.0 is normally seen to be the interactive element, right? The degree to which, with which Wikipedia perhaps exemplifies the most. And I'm going to spend some time talking about Wikipedia because it seems to me that what happens to that, in a way, is an indication of what Web 3.0 might be about. Okay? And so then the question becomes, what is Web 3.0? And Andy was suggesting the possibility that it might lead to some kind of collective intelligence. Now, as you were saying that's quite an interesting hypothesis, because though it kind of goes against the spirit in which Wikipedia was itself originated, because I was recently reading about Jimbo Wales, who's one of the co-founders of Wikipedia along with Larry Sanger, and what exactly inspired him to start this idea, and it was his reading of Friedrich Hayek's essay, The Use of Knowledge in Society, which is about collective intelligence in a very specific kind of way, and not necessarily in the way in which one might think about it, right? In other words, it's collective only in the sense of being aggregated. Right, so we're not talking about, as it were, a certain kind of second-order knowledge emerging that might count as collective knowledge for everyone, but rather it's distributed knowledge, distributed aggregated knowledge. Right, that's what Hayek's talking about. It's basically the epistemology of the free market. Okay, and that's what motivated the founding of Wikipedia. Okay, and then Larry Sanger, who since that time has become kind of a heretic, moving away, starting this other thing, Citizendium, right, which is a kind of Wikipedia with experts in it, right? He's very concerned that there won't be any kind of boundary as to what's true or false and so forth if it's just left to this kind of free market kind of mechanism, right? In the sense, Wikipedia is very much caught in that kind of divide there. And I think so. When we talk about collective intelligence and talking about Web 3.0, we got to be clear what exactly we're talking about. Because there's no doubt, right, that there's aggregation going on, there's distribution going on. But is there some kind of second order form of knowledge? In other words, is there a sense in which the whole is greater than the sum of the parts? And that's not clear, right? And it's not even clear that that was part of the intention. Okay. And so, why is this an important point? Well, because we have this idea, from our, as it were, pre-IT days about knowledge, that knowledge is a public good. Okay? And for knowledge to be a public good, it has to be available to more than just the people who are contributing to it. Right? And in fact, the economists often define public good as a good that it would actually cost more to restrict people from participating in than to allow them, even if they're not contributing anything. Okay, so public utilities often fit this sort of definition of a public good. Okay, and it seems to me that this whole idea of knowledge for everyone, where you allow everyone to have it and they can all participate and so forth, that requires a really strong commitment to the idea of a public that isn't necessarily present at the moment. And one of the ways you see that, of course, is in something like Wikipedia, where the participation is very self-selecting. Right? I have this kind of image that 95% of the people who participate in Wikipedia are basically men without lives who like science fiction overly much and have an hyperactive sexual imagination, especially with machines. You know, that's kind of my image of the people who participate in Wikipedia, okay? And maybe I'm a little bit off. But in any case, it's not representative of the population as a whole. And there are no measures in place to enable the population as a whole or to encourage the population as a whole to actually get involved in this thing. And of course, as you know, Wikipedia is the most widely used reference source in the world, right? And it's consistently in the top 10 of things that is being accessed on the web and so forth. Nevertheless, it is being constructed by a very self-selected group of people, right, who are not by any means representative of the entire population, and gradually this thing is getting an incredible amount of authority. I mean, Cass Sunstein, you know, the legal theorist in the United States, in his book Infotopia, was remarking on the fact that now the Supreme Court cites Wikipedia as often as it cites the Encyclopedia Britannica as a source, you know, on what knowledge is. And indeed, this is one reason why Sanger is getting worried and wants to start this alternative kind of expert-driven version of Wikipedia. So it seems to me that, you know, if we're talking about, you know, Web 3.0 is producing a kind of collective intelligence, yes, that is kind of happening in a way, but it isn't happening in a way that enables the knowledge produced to be a public good, certainly not in the sense of being representative of the public, including those who use the internet, or public in the sense of actually efforts being made within the process itself to enable everyone to get involved in it. Basically, you have to be kind of computer literate to kind of really interact with this in a very serious way. And as time goes on, it becomes harder and harder. Right? I mean, because it's quite clear there are editorial gatekeepers have emerged within this process, and they make it quite difficult, actually, to make changes and things of that kind. Right, so you get very specific kinds of interpretations of the general rules that are operating for contributing to this. Okay, and there's nothing to stop any of this at the moment, you see? I mean, this is the thing. This is, it's a sort of this Hayekian thing going on, right? It's just sort of happening. And it's developing its own implicit rules. And it's gradually gaining an enormous amount of authority. But no one has ever really officially signed on board to this. It's just happening. Okay. And the interesting thing, of course, is, if this were happening in something other than cyberspace, we would consider this a real big problem. This is the kind of thing that we have state intervention for. This is the kind of thing where we would think about redistribution and regulation in a very heavy kind of way if it were happening anywhere else but the internet. Okay. And given that, in fact, the model from this comes from outside the internet with regard to Hayek, it seems to me it's reasonable to start thinking in these terms. It's not that. See, I actually think Larry Sanger's got the wrong take on this because he's doing this very kind of old-fashioned thing, you know. So In a way, he's very much acting like the way aristocrats acted in the 18th century when the market started to open up, right? Where basically they say, my God, you got all these people coming in and trying to make businesses and stuff from scratch, and so we have to return to sort of the old ways. And so what we want to do is we want to reassert the experts, and we want to reassert the domains over which they had expertise. That was kind of the classic kind of 18th century kind of battle between the landed gentry and the emerging bourgeoisie. And in a sense, Sanger and Wales are kind of reenacting that 18th century battle here. But what you don't have is anyone thinking in terms of what's in the interest of the public. If we imagine that a large amount of genuine public life, as traditionally understood, is going to be conducted on the internet and public sources of knowledge are going to be there. We really don't have a lot of smart political thinking about this. Okay, and so that is, it seems to me, that's on the table for Web 3.0. Now, one book that I recommend that I've been reading and it's enabling me to think about this in clear ways is a book by a guy at Swansea University called David Berry called Copy, Rip, and Burn. Okay, came out earlier this year. And this book basically is trying to sort of map all this out, and it's written from the standpoint of someone who knows a lot about the history of property law and public goods and all this kind of stuff. And what he does in the book, in an interesting way, is play off the notion of copyleft, okay, against the idea of open source. He sees these two things as quite different developments, but very much part of this emerging world that we're entering into. I want to say a little bit about historical precedents for both of these kinds of ideas, because I do think they represent something that is happening, and in a way we have to be clear about. So the copyleft idea is in a way very much designed against copyright. It's to allow as much as possible sort of the free transit of knowledge and ideas, right, with just kind of a formal acknowledgement that, you know, of the person from whom it is derived. Okay, so it's not, it's completely, sort of separated out from any kind of financial considerations. But it's just a kind of an acknowledgement thing. And this, the precedent for this actually does come from the Enlightenment. And a certain kind of view about what exactly the free flow of knowledge meant in the Enlightenment. And there you have certain kinds of assumptions that are not Hayek's assumptions operating. Okay. In the first place, there's this idea that everyone's entitled to have access to knowledge in principle. Okay, which is to say that if you don't have access to knowledge for whatever reason, that is itself prima facie a problem. Right, it's not just that you have to already have the skills to get the knowledge, but rather if you don't have the skills to get the knowledge, there's a problem. Right, and so what you do, the idea of the free flow of knowledge is to remove the barriers in the way from people getting access to knowledge. Right, so these Enlightenment guys basically believe that knowledge ought to be moving the way air moves. Right, and Adam Smith has this sense of the air being like a public good. Right, well, knowledge should be that way as well, and the only reason why it's not that way is because there are actually some artificial barriers, and those artificial barriers often have to do with things like expertise, which then, as it were, cast things in very esoteric languages so people can't understand. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things, and in order to get access to the knowledge, you have to be able to pay for the education, and so there are all these kinds of, as it were, economic barriers to people getting access to knowledge that is, in fact, they are entitled to. And so the idea is to remove all those barriers. Okay, and so that's kind of one kind of model, and it's quite different from the Hayek model, because the Hayek model basically says the knowledge belongs to those who construct it, the ones who are actually doing it. There's no, as it were, there's no natural entitlement other than through your participation, and that, as we see, ends up becoming very self-selecting and ends up restricting the access in the long term. Okay, so the Enlightenment idea is one where you start with a kind of an a priori notion, basically, about human beings, right? They're all entitled to this, and if they don't have access to it, that's the problem that has to be somehow remedied through legal or economic means. Now, there's this issue of open source is kind of interesting, and it's a kind of contrasting notion. Oh, one more thing. Let me say one more thing about the copyleft business. The business of acknowledging that someone is the originator of the thing that you are, in fact, using, okay? This also harks back to a kind of Enlightenment notion, which is, what is the nature of the reward one gets for originating a piece of knowledge? Okay, because you got to remember, the idea of there being scientists and professional knowledge producers, in the sense of people who you know spend their whole lives and get paid for it on a regular basis, is a 19th century idea. So if we're talking about the Enlightenment, we're back in the 18th century, and so the business of producing knowledge was still seen, for the most part, as kind of a leisure activity. Okay, and that the reason why you would do it, right, in a sense, what do you want to get out of it? You want to get recognition, right, where recognition is different from remuneration. Okay, and so you want your name attached to it. And so this is why one of the big ways to sort of promote knowledge during the Enlightenment was to have contests, prizes. Right? And the prizes were like not the of the amount that would enable you to retire or anything. The presumption was that if you're working on these, in this contest in the first place, you probably have enough money to waste time. Right? So the point is not the money. Right? The point is the recognition. And so the whole point about the copyleft thing is that you give recognition to the person who originated, right, the thing, right? But it's not about money at all. Okay? Because what you want to do is you want to live on in the memory, collective memory, of the society, and that's where you get your the value of what you've done is put forward. Okay, so that's the kind of the copyleft notion, and for somebody like Berry, that's an attractive option. Okay, what he's not so attracted to is this open source idea, and this has a lot to do with the political economy in which it's wrapped up. Now, open source is a very interesting kind of concept in the sense that it is not just limited to information technology at all. I mean, in a sense, we're sort of open sourcing everything these days, right? I mean, so for example, with biotechnology, we're open sourcing life to the extent that now, I don't know how familiar you are, there is this thing called DIY bio. 5 minutes? Okay. God, I didn't realize that. DIY bio, right? We sort of artificial life thing where people kind of get organisms and they sort of reverse engineer them and they start messing around with them and they share the information with everyone else. So it's kind of like a hobbyist kind of approach to creating new life forms. And this was originated by a bunch of guys who were, primarily trained in engineering at MIT, there's a website for it and everything, and it's kind of catching on as a kind of bottom-up artificial life thing. And that's another version of open source. Open source biology, basically. Okay, but of course there's this open source stuff with regard to digital code. And the problem that he sees with this, which is an interesting problem, it isn't the fact that, you can change the code around and so forth. That itself is not the problem. The problem, rather, is who gets to capture the knowledge and do something with it. Because insofar as this stuff happens in the open, right, and happens publicly, through user groups and things of that kind, right? Businesses, firms that in a way can really capitalize on whatever changes are being made can just capture the stuff and run away with it. Okay, so in a sense, what you do is you have all these, enthusiastic hobbyists, right, who are coming up with all these new combination of things, some of which work, some of which don't work, some of which have interesting consequences, but who actually benefits from it in the long term? Right. Again, as long as we're operating in a free market environment, right? Basically, whatever firm is available to be able to mass produce this stuff can end up getting some kind of patent on it and then closing the market down. Okay. This is one reason why Microsoft encourages users to kind of mess around with various new programs they have and then looking at the consequences of it and then sort of, coming up with their next version of things. Right, they don't actually have to hire anyone to do it. People just do it spontaneously, and then they capture the profits from it. And the open source movement is very much in that kind. Okay, and this harks back to another aspect of what happened in the early modern period. And with that, I'll stop there. And that is what happened to the Industrial Revolution, because in the beginning, right, the Industrial Revolution was about a lot of self-made people who came up with inventions, and you know the names of the famous inventors like Watt and Arkwright and all these people, right? And you wonder, and they had a certain amount of success, they had a certain amount of publicity. But then, of course, as you see over time, you know, large multinational firms develop that sort of capture everything and develop everything, and as it were, channel and streamline the subsequent development of industry, right? Making it harder and harder for startups to get involved. And that's kind of like what the history of industry to a large extent has been about, especially as we move into the 20th century. And there's a concern that this might happen here too with this so-called open source movement, that in a sense it might just be a sort of temporary thing, a kind of version of the Industrial Revolution, which, you know, 50 years down the line or even sooner will become, you know, sort of a version of monopoly capitalism essentially. Okay, and so he's very concerned about it, and I do share his concerns. But well, as I was saying, I just want to, sort of, you know, since we are in shortage of time here, and I want to open it up to questions. It seems to me this is kind of the crossroads in which we're located at the moment, and the real reason for this, I think, is just because there's not an adequate political theory to understand the development of the net at this point, and the one that sort of founded something like Wikipedia, it seems to be woefully inadequate unless one is really a devotee of the free market. But what we don't have is any sense of what public good means in this new realm that we're entering into, and I'll stop there.
We've got about 15 minutes for questions. We're trying to have as much Q&A as we can during the afternoon. So, can I open it up to anyone that would like to ask the first question?
Don't all jump in at once.
the chair tends to have to go first, right?
So, okay.
You know, I'm fed up with my Wikipedia in.
Hey, join the queue, man. Yeah.
Edit my Wikipedia, then, you know, go ahead, please, because it's absolutely inaccurate.
No.
And I tried to alter it. You know, if you ever had to go altering anything on Wikipedia, you know that you suddenly find yourself in front of the wrath of any number of Wikipedians that scribe who say, well, you can't write that, you can't write this, and it just becomes quite difficult to actually do anything, especially with things that relate to your own content.
Right.
So I wonder how many of the people working here in arts organizations have Wikipedia entries for their organizations. And I guess my question to you is, mm-hmm. you know, in the context of what you describe, which I think in some ways is really a critique of the politics of Web 2.0 and the mm-hmm. internet more broadly, given that we are amongst artistic organizations, often people that try to challenge those sorts of ideologies, mm-hmm. should everyone here go about and set up their own Wikipedia entry?
No, I mean, one thing I have suggested in an article is that that at the level of schooling, in a sense, the official rules of Wikipedia are actually well designed for students to get involved. You know, and there's a sense in which part of the if insofar as this the web that we happen to live in is a Hayekian universe, the short-term solution is to get more people involved, okay, and to make it part of the educational process generally, okay. But I also think that. Well, I think that maybe there is something to be said for thinking about official government policy, you know, public sort of discussion about this matter. I mean, I think at the moment Wikipedia is seen as just sort of, even though it is the most widely used reference source, it's nevertheless seen to be just sort of the domain of those who actually are normally involved in it, right? But I do think that you. In a sense, you have to interact with it. You have to engage with it. There's no. I don't buy Sanger's solution of starting up some alternative thing. I mean, there's a sense in which you actually have to engage with it and engage with it in a very systematic way. Because if you just withdraw from it, they just continue to roll over you. That would be my view about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Expressing your identity and the things you say. I think that, I mean, if you look at education, it's still consumer-based. Mm-hmm. You sit and you receive. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole idea of, say, a grassroots movement is also just to teach people actually to express yourself as something else than just to take in information. And therefore, it would be interesting to see your thoughts about how you could sort of teach people more about their identity, because Web 2.0 is about expressing identity, and it becomes knowledge.
Yeah.
And that it connects things. So,
Start I know, I agree. I think something like Wikipedia, though, undermines this because of policies like the neutral point of view, you know, that you can't do original research, Right. If you think about the rules for Wikipedia, I mean, one of the things I've said in an article that's been syndicated in places is that it's kind of like a medieval encyclopedia, where, as it were, personal identity is completely submerged. Right, and so in a sense, it really goes against that kind of idea. So it's often very difficult for the people about, you know, the people about whom the articles are to actually be able to contribute, right? Because they have personal information which is not allowed by Wikipedia's rules, even though it is about, you know, the article's about them. Okay, so I do think that. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but I do think that with something like Wikipedia, that would be really quite a challenging move, right, to sort of, to make that kind of point. And if you look at somebody like Sanger, right, the only expression that, you know, self-expression that he's really willing to countenance is the self-expression of the experts, very much in the spirit of the classical Encyclopedia Britannica articles, where you get these, you know, really kind of classic pieces by somebody really on top of their field, and that becomes authoritative.
Mm-hmm. If you take it into, say, primary schools and have the kids understand,
yeah,
the expression of art, and, you know, just read books and achieve
them. Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think, frankly, that, you know, with regard to these IT skills, you know, use of wikis generally and so forth, that kids ought to be introduced to that at the very basic level. I mean, one of the things that we've been having a battle about in my department, not a battle exactly, in the sense that it's not an ideological opposition, but the idea of actually including as part of social research methodology, teaching students how to make films, right, and how to edit films. Right, not only so they can interpret how films are, but also so that they can participate in the process as a way of producing knowledge themselves. There are still, you know, questions about exactly in what sense is this a methodology or so forth. But it seems to me that this is something that really does need to be introduced as early as possible, and certainly by the time of university, it should be part of normal social research methods.
So one thing I correct.
Well, no, that's right. That's right. But you need to get it in the curriculum. You do need to get it in the curriculum. And the tricky thing, and this is where the issue of narrative, historical narrative, comes in, justifying it as a methodology. Because to a lot of my colleagues, this is not obvious.
Yeah. Okay, we have one at the back.
Yes.
And I sort of, when I was speaking, sort of had questions about, well, what's the incentive?
Yeah, exactly.
In that I can produce learning to my students, but the extra effort that it would take to make that a useful resource to somebody else is quite significant. Now, without any incentive to do that, either through recognition or
No, I agree 100%. And here, it's very interesting because I think academics have very poor sense of the causal structure of knowledge distribution. right? There's, a, you know, so for example, we're always preoccupied in academia with having impact on things, right? I mean, but the way in which we set up the incentives to enable academics to do this actually do not necessarily facilitate. So, for example, we have to publish in peer-reviewed journals. Like, who reads them, right? Who cites the articles in them? But nevertheless, that's the gold standard, right? So, in the first instance, that's what you should be orienting yourself toward, right? And, you know, insofar as you're orienting yourself to a larger public, it's typically going to be with particular firms or businesses, right? Which, again, they're the ones who end up capturing the intellectual property, and so, again, it avoids the public sphere altogether. Now, ideally what you'd want to do is set up incentives so people actually communicate to the larger public and find it in their interest to actually make things more open and more plain, because, trust me, it can always be done. It can almost always be done, especially now with this multimedia environment. It's really, you're right, it's only lack of incentive. But at the moment, academics don't seem to understand that. They think that, in a sense, the way to have kind of authoritative impact on the public is through peer-reviewed processes or through hooking up with industry in some very direct way. And I think that represents, in a way, academia's lack of self-confidence. You know, in other words, it really has to shore itself up before it can actually face the public directly. It can't actually present its knowledge in an open forum. And I think that's a real kind of hang-up that academia has at the moment. I think it's viable if you've got some kind of state thing going on. So, for example, if you guarantee media literacy, you know, you make that part of what every student, you know, every kid has to have, and you sort of enforce that in a way that enables them to participate very directly, you know, in these web creative processes and so forth. I mean, you need a kind of comprehensive policy on this, which is what is currently lacking. Okay, because at the moment what we have are these self-generating things like Wikipedia and you know, sort of the government just sort of sitting by, right? And really don't get interested unless there's some money involved. And so I think that's kind of what you need. You really need a really kind of thoughtful, comprehensive government policy on this to enable everyone to get involved, because it's not going to happen by itself, by no means. In fact, we already know, right, you're getting this kind of, you know, the no's and the no-nots, right, just like the haves and the have-nots of the past, right? Somewhat different, perhaps, in terms of how they split up, but it's happening already. And that's not going to go away by itself. That's going to require some real intervention at the level of education. And I'm a little surprised that there's not more active intervention on the part of the government this way.
Do you think that educational institutions such as universities could get together on this? Because the Wikipedia thing seems a bit like the Bible, but it's kind of like the authority, but basically it's been rewritten,
yeah.
So you can't get in on it. But then kind of like need something at the other end, which are, you know, the expert thing, which would be quite useful. I mean, can I just say, I love Insight, which is, you know, the proper books, you know, because at least you knew it was some kind of an authority, but at least if you've got various experts commenting, you can actually make your own mind, well, he says this, da, 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 and actually at least, you know, people with some reasonable education can say, well, that expert says this, this expert says that, that. It's probably somewhere in the middle, and then it's going to move on.
Yeah.
Whereas Wikipedia is just rewritten. So maybe something at that spectrum, and something at the, and then something in the middle will naturally fall. I thought that could be a possibility. And also, you know, the micropayment system is a bit like what's going on with PRS at the moment, and YouTube, which proposed these. PRS, brilliant. Blast. You know, somebody's taken on YouTube, whereby the micropayment system, they're going to hold out for it, and I think that's a very wise thing to do. And actually, I've got interesting. I work for the National Museum of Liverpool, and just a very practical example of what goes on today. Somebody who's a developer who's developing some very posh properties near a small residence of ours, a venue of ours called Sudley House, has just rang me up and just said, "Oh, I don't suppose you've got a lovely photo of Sudley House, so we can pop it in our brochures and we can sell these huge developments." And ordinarily and usually, and what we've always done before, is given them the photo and say, you know, just credit us.
Yeah.
And today, I thought, why the hell should we credit you when we've taken the photograph? We paid the photographer probably, I don't know, a couple of hundred quid, 300 quid, 500 quid, whatever it was. Why should I fling out my photograph? You just say, oh, courtesy of National Museum of Liverpool. And I just think, actually, it's rubbish. We shouldn't be doing that. We should say, actually, actually, mate, it's going to cost you £100. Because basically recognition is actually so what? We've got so much knowledge to do with recognition, it's so what? But micropayments, recognition, where should we be? What's public good? What would help from the work of the museum?
Well, I mean, I think I think one thing that really complicates the situation now from the time of the Enlightenment is that, you know, we are now literally knowledge producers who have to make money off of this in the way that wasn't the case in the Enlightenment, where knowledge producer was merely a metaphor, right? I mean, it's literal now. So all this issue about payments becomes kind of relevant in a sense that it wasn't back then. But one thing you said earlier about Wikipedia and having all these other sort of sources of expertise that one can draw on, I think actually Wikipedia would, even though I have a very horrendous entry myself, very long and nasty, but the thing that's interesting about it is that if you actually were to, again, as part of the sort of media literacy thing, if people were actually told, you know, if people were taught at an early age how to read Wikipedia articles, especially to read the discussion sections and the history sections, and to be able to engage in that kind of, dare I say, hermeneutical exercise, right, of the various revisions that take place, right? Because all of that is there, right? There's a sense in which you can kind of see the nastiness unfold in a very direct way, and if you know how to read the thing, you can see where that stuff's coming from, and then you, of course, you've got the rest of the web to do some cross-referencing, because very often in the discussion pages, you know, will be the things that have been tossed out. And I think that's kind of...
He was a nice man, actually.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, but I do think, see, again, if we take this idea of, you know, critical media literacy seriously, then Wikipedia, even with all the nasty entries and things, doesn't become so much of a problem anymore, because then people will read it, you know, give it, as it were, the grain of salt it deserves kind of thing. But at the moment, you know, people will just read the article and ignore all the other bits. Yeah, and there's this guy over here too. Well, I do think these people in the Enlightenment believed that we were founts of boundless creativity. Okay, I mean, maybe you don't believe this, but I do think they had a very optimistic view that, you know, say, okay, you know, you give away this stuff, people appropriate it, but you've got more where that came from, don't you? Right?
Still so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think what she said earlier is the best general strategy, namely you never just rely on one source, right? I mean, you rely on multiple sources, and you especially look for differences among them and then try to discriminate. But I don't know. I don't see it as necessarily any worse than whatever the alternative was before we had the web. Do you? I don't know if we can remember back that far, but...
Andrew Keane kind of
well, sure. Yeah, but see, this is... Okay, well, then what I think what you're objecting to is the market environment in which this stuff is floating. I mean, this is the... You know, in a sense... Because people like customized news to begin with. That's the first problem, right? There's a sense in which part of what you're complaining about isn't just the producers, but the consumers. The consumers aren't sufficiently sophisticated as far as you're concerned. It's not just a producer problem. Okay, and as long as you leave the dissemination of information to a marketplace, right, you're going to get these kinds of results. It's only if you come in with some kind of prior notion, you know, like we should have a kind of a newspaper that covers all different kinds of news in a relatively fair fashion, blah, 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 and that should somehow be insured or somehow guaranteed or underwritten in some way. But again, that requires regulation. There's no reason to think that's just going to spontaneously arise through a free market activity. Okay, so you're kind of alluding to a norm, which I share, but I don't think happens naturally. And I don't think it happens, you know, and so this is, you're right. What we mean by democracy here is very interesting. Because at the moment, the kind of democracy we have is a market democracy. And a market democracy will not reproduce the norms that we traditionally upheld, you know, in our enlightenment pre-IT culture. Right? And if we do want to reassert those, we are going to have to take some very special kind of political action, it seems to me. It's not going to happen naturally. Well, this is where, the media literacy thing. Teach the kids early how to read critically all this stuff on the web. I mean, in a sense, that's the first line of defense, okay? And really, you know, embedded into the curriculum. You know, make it as fundamental as, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, right? Is some kind of web and media literacy more generally. And just put it at the same level, frankly. Okay, and we really need to be committed to that in a very serious way, and provide. I think we need to provide a proper historical backstory to justify that, right? And I think the problem is at the moment there are various snobbish issues and kind of weird ways of reading history which make it look like, you know, media literacy some artificial thing, you know, that isn't really fundamental. But of course it's fundamental. It deals with our senses. I mean, if you look at the way in which the whole media thing operates, it's just as fundamental as reading, writing, and arithmetic, and we don't really have an education or a pedagogy for that. And that's the thing that really needs to be done. And once you do that, yes, then you can count on people to sort their way through the web and all that. But it's not just going to happen spontaneously. I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, it doesn't happen spontaneously. I mean, people just use whatever resources they've got, and they end up getting the mixed results you see.
Got a few more hands. One at the back there. And then you.
Yeah. Right. Yes. He's against it. That's right.
Social engineer society. Mm-hmm. Is against this whole idea of freedom. So he wrote this book.
The Road to Serfdom. Right.
Which brings social order.
Mm-hmm.
Causes this idea. And of course, from the title I picked up on this was my obsession.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's a little bit different. I mean, the thing about Margaret Thatcher and her power was the power to divest, the connection between the state and industry. So at the level of the industrial economy, she was very powerful, but she wasn't really dealing with this kind of web stuff that we're talking about here, right? And this is where people like Wales come in. I mean, I think the interesting thing here is that Hayek's basic challenge to us is to, because he would say to the kind of thing I've been saying so far, is that whatever you do to try to regulate the web and the internet to try to make it, you know, more whatever, egalitarian, democratic, make it more critical, will fail. It'll be worse than just letting it sort of function spontaneously. That's his hypothesis, right? That's his hypothesis. And I think, as your remarks indicated, right, he operates with a very polarized view of the world, it seems to me, right, where it's either free markets or it's authoritarianism, okay? And here I think it's very interesting to see the kind of to-ing and fro-ing that he had with Karl Popper, who was, of course, a believer in the idea of piecemeal social engineering, right? So Popper occupies a kind of middle position in this argument. And that's kind of what I would suggest with regard to this business of the web. I actually do think that the state, at least, you know, at the very least through the educational system in terms of requiring media literacy to enable citizens to empower themselves so they can go into the web with open eyes and, you know, kind of fully armed, as it were. But maybe at some more regulatory level, who knows, but to be experimental about it. And I think at the moment we really don't have a good state policy on this at all. Okay, but I would kind of move a little bit more in that direction. Okay, so I'm not arguing for, you know, Soviet control of the internet or anything like that. No. And I think part of the Hayekian ideology is to make it look like that if you move away from the free market, you're just going to slide into Sovietism.
Okay, I've been told to stop it there, unfortunately. We have a couple more questions, but we're staying in here for the coffee break, so feel free to sleep afterwards. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you. New York. But I've been here for 15 years.
Oh, I've been here for 11. How shocked were you when you came here and found how people here despise the thought of studying media? Yeah. You talk about media literacy. You know, that in this country, it's like, why would you have...
I know where you're coming from. I mean, I studied in the States before coming here.
Yeah.
And I just, I'm trying to set up a couple of things, like, things about new media, so sort of giving students the opportunity to engage with new media while experiencing it. And everybody just looks at me as if I'm an alien or something.
Really? Even now? Even today?
Yeah.